appeared at risk. So, as he set out for the fall session of Congress in October 1794, the alleged general wrote to the putative Generalissimo that he would always receive your commands with pleasure and shall continue to drop you a line as occasions turn up. It was essentially a resumption of the old relationship of the Paris years, with Madison sending regular reports from the political cockpit in Philadelphia and Jefferson receiving them in a distant location that afforded him the tranquility to listen and respond in the meditative mode he preferred. For the first year, Jefferson's indifference to political news was nearly total. Madison's detailed reports on the prospects for Republican candidates in various state elections produced only yawning silence from Monticello, along with the reminder that he did not really follow such matters anymore and had stopped subscribing to newspapers so as not to be bothered with the petty details. When Madison passed along diplomatic correspondence with queries about the proper course for American foreign policy, Jefferson expressed no interest. "Make any answer you please for me. If it had been on the rotation of my crops, I would have answered myself, lengthily perhaps, but certainly con gusto." Or when Attorney General Edmund Randolph wrote asking if he might be willing to head up the American negotiating effort with Spain, Jefferson slammed the door defiantly. "No circumstances, my dear sir, will ever more tempt me to engage in anything public. I thought myself perfectly fixed in this determination when I left Philadelphia, but every day and hour since has added to its inflexibility." No matter what his friends in Philadelphia were secretly thinking, much less his enemies not so secretly saying, he was done with politics forever. The first tiny cracks in this adamant position began to appear in the winter of 1794-95. During the previous summer, a popular insurgency in four counties of western Pennsylvania had prompted Washington to call out the militia. The rebels were protesting collection of an excise tax on whiskey that Hamilton had advocated in order to pay for the federal assumption of state debts in 1791. Western farmers considered the tax unfair because it fell disproportionately on their most exportable product. Whiskey was the most convenient way to market their grain. And a self-proclaimed army of 7,000 whiskey rebels had marched through Pittsburgh in a massive display of frontier protest. An even more massive display of federal military power, nearly 13,000 troops, had put down the rebellion quickly and with a minimum of violence. Jefferson tended to view the entire affair as a shameful repetition of the Shays Rebellion fiasco, in which an essentially healthy and rather harmless expression of popular discontent by ordinary American farmers had prompted a military response by the government vastly more repressive than the situation required. Nevertheless, he refrained from making any comment throughout the fall of 1794, despite overtures from Madison to condemn what he regarded as the government's overreaction. What drew him into the debate was a speech Washington delivered to Congress in the aftermath of the Whiskey Rebellion, denouncing certain self-created societies as subversive organizations that fomented discontent and defied the authority of the legitimate government. Washington's attack on the so-called Democratic-Republican societies prompted Madison to sound an alarm designed to pierce the rural serenity surrounding his friend at Monticello. Washington's speech was, Madison said, an attack on the most sacred principle of our Constitution and republicanism, and was artfully orchestrated, undoubtedly by Hamilton, to link the Republican critics of the Federalist government with whiskey and rebellion. Madison smelled a conspiracy of just the sort Jefferson had often warned against, the covert monarchists in the executive branch of the government scheming to subvert the liberties of the people. It was imperative that Jefferson rouse himself from his lair and join the fight. "If the people of America are so far degenerated as not to see that the citadel of their liberties is menaced by the precedent before their eyes, they require abler advocates than they now have to save them from the consequences." Jefferson, in effect, budged, but he did not move. Madison's assessment of what was afoot was obviously correct. The denunciation of the democratic societies, Jefferson agreed, is one of the extraordinary acts of boldness of which we have seen so many from the faction of monocrats. Washington was just as obviously a prop for Hamilton's political ambitions. The president's speech reminded him of shreds of stuff from Aesop's Fables and Tom Thumb. Clear evidence the president himself did not write it. But then came a sudden and, at least as far as Madison was concerned, an unexpected reversal. Hold on, then, my dear friend. I do not see in the minds of those with whom I converse a greater affliction than the fear of your retirement, but this must not be, unless to a more splendid and efficacious post. There I should rejoice to see you. But double delicacies have kept me silent. I ought perhaps to say, while I would not give up my own retirement for the empire of the universe, how can I justify wishing one whose happiness I have as much at heart as yours to take the front of the battle which is fighting for my security? This was an elegantly indirect way of refusing the invitation to end his own retirement, along with a clear invitation to Madison to assume complete command of the Republican cause and prepare himself for a run at the presidency. Though aroused by the news from Philadelphia, he wanted Madison to know that, like it or not, the torch had been passed to him. Although Jefferson meant what he said, the debate over the Democratic-Republican societies stirred up the old juices. His letters during the first half of 1795 contained periodic bursts of political invective in the midst of longer and more languid conversations about his wheat crop and the weather. He wrote William Branch Giles that the use of federal troops to restrain the liberty of our citizens meeting together had signaled a decisive shift toward tyranny, a full century earlier than I expected. Even Washington, who had been spared direct criticism on the questionable supposition that Hamilton was manipulating his words and decisions, now came in for attack. Washington had provided the Hamiltonians with the sanction of a name which has done too much good not to be sufficient to cover harm also. But these political outbursts, to repeat, usually occurred within the context of more temperate and philosophical musings in the bucolic mode and firm resolutions of pastoral contentment. Letters to Madison probably best reflected the mixed state of Jefferson's mind at this time. Requests for copies of his previous correspondence as Secretary of State with Edmund Genet coming right before requests for the most recent pamphlet on crop rotation. News on the elections to the House of Representatives from Virginia districts, followed by a lengthy exegesis on the marvelous curative power of vetch as a fallow crop in his old tobacco fields. The happily retired farmer philosopher was doing battle with the reluctant but ready leader of the Republican Party at some subconscious level of Jefferson's personality, but he preferred to keep the conflict below the surface, invisible even to himself, all the better to sustain what remained the dominant impression that he was still immune to political temptation. If one were looking to find a precise moment when Jefferson's political interests began to win the interior struggle, a good choice would be the day after Christmas, 1795. On that date, he mailed $8 to Benjamin Franklin Bache for a year's subscription to Bache's Aurora, a leading Republican newspaper. While not yet ready to enter the public debate, he had moved to the point of acknowledging that he wished to follow it. But of course, Jefferson's evolution toward a resumption of his public career was a process more than a moment. The pace of his commentary on politics quickened in his letters in late 1795 and early 1796, which was also the time when the demolition efforts at Monticello went forward at full speed, suggesting that he was fully capable of juggling several versions of his future life without any sense of contradiction. Hamilton was in the news at this time. He had announced his decision to resign from the cabinet. A congressional investigation of accounting irregularities in his office was proceeding apace. Anything involving a prospective exposure of Hamilton caught Jefferson's attention. He utterly loathed the man, and the investigation seemed to sanction Jefferson's own, albeit surreptitious, efforts to catch Hamilton cooking the books 3 years earlier. "I do not at all wonder at the condition in which the finances of the U.S. are found," he wrote Madison. Hamilton's object from the beginning was to throw them into forms which would be utterly undecipherable. I even said he did not understand their condition himself. Coming as they did from a man whose own meticulous accounting of his personal finances never seemed capable of producing a realistic rendering of the proverbial bottom line, Jefferson's critical remarks on Hamilton's financial confusion are richly ironic. They also call attention to yet another possible influence on Jefferson's thinking about a return to the public arena, this time at a depth that not only eluded his conscious scrutiny, but also puts a strain on our own limited knowledge about the irrational sources of human motivation in general. For Jefferson's congenital suspicion of Hamilton's cavalier way with budgets merely hinted at his much deeper suspicion that Hamilton's real intention was to increase the national debt in order to justify expanding federal power over the economy, including the power to tax, manipulate credit rates, and establish all the accoutrements of a modern nation-state along English lines. On this score, he was not entirely wrong. Debt, then, was the key device that made the whole Hamiltonian scheme possible. So if Jefferson were to re-enter the political arena, one of his highest priorities would be the reduction and elimination of the public debt. But his obsession with public debt rested cheek by jowl with his own cavalier way with his personal debt. Just how this intriguing disjunction between personal habit and public policy actually operated inside Jefferson's character is difficult to capture confidently, though paradox is obviously at work. At the personal level, Jefferson's intricate record-keeping probably bolstered his false confidence that his own debt problem was under control. It clearly was not, and the decision to rebuild Monticello helped assure that it never would be. The looming decision to end his retirement and re-enter politics could be seen, then, as a flight from the apparently intractable problem of his personal indebtedness. He would solve publicly what he could not solve privately. Whatever the interactive pattern might have been, it seems fair to say that the problem of debt haunted him at both levels. That his hatred of Hamilton was fueled by personal demons he did not fully understand himself, and that the process of thinking about returning to public life involved a complex blend of emotional and ideological considerations. The decisive event in that process was much more explicit and readily identifiable, namely the passage of the Jay Treaty, which was simultaneously a landmark in the shaping of American foreign policy, a decisive influence on the constitutional question of executive power in foreign affairs, and the occasion for Jefferson's resumption of leadership in the Republican Party. If Jefferson was already leaning toward returning to the political wars in Philadelphia, claiming all the while that his retirement was forever and meaning every word, the battle over the Jay Treaty pulled him all the way over and ended all pretenses of remaining a Ciceronian presence in American politics. The passage of the Jay Treaty was a great victory for the Federalists, but it was Jefferson who understood, more than anyone else, that it was a victory from which his enemies could never fully recover. It turned out to be the launching site of his eventually successful campaign for the presidency. The story had its origins in the early months of 1795. Madison sent reports to Monticello that the terms of the treaty that John Jay had negotiated with England were still secret, but that Federalists with inside information do not assume an air of triumph, from which it is inferred that the bargain is much less in our favor than ought be expected. It would be wrong to prejudge, he cautioned, but I suspect that Jay has been betrayed by his anxiety to couple us with England and to avoid returning with his finger in his mouth. At this early stage of the story, Jefferson refused to rise to the bait. His letters back to Madison did not mention the ominous implications of the Jay Treaty at all, preferring instead to discuss a somewhat bizarre proposal to transfer the University of Geneva to Virginia, request delivery of a letter to a prospective fresco painter for Monticello's new walls, and wax eloquent on vetch as the ideal rotation crop. Madison's fears about the terms of the treaty seemed more than justified, as knowledge of its contents leaked out from the special session of the Senate called to vote on it in the summer of 1795. It then spread, as Madison put it, with an electric velocity to every part of the Union. The initial public reaction was almost wholly negative. John Jay later claimed the entire eastern seaboard of the United States was illuminated each evening by the fires from burning effigies of his likeness. Popular opinion rallied around the Republican charge that Jay had betrayed American honor as well as American interests in return for a few scraps of English patronage. In New York, Alexander Hamilton was struck in the head by a rock and forced to withdraw while attempting to address a rally against the treaty, and the local militia proposed a mock toast to Jay and Federalist Senator Rufus King. "May the cage constructed to coop up the American eagle prove a trap for none but jays and kingbirds." Jefferson's initial response combined outrage with exhortation. He began giving orders again. Madison must take on Hamilton, who was already heating up the public presses with editorials in behalf of the treaty. "Hamilton is really a colossus to the anti-Republican Party. Without numbers, he is a host within himself. They have got themselves in a defile where they might be finished, but too much security on the Republican part will give time to his talents. We have had only middling performances to oppose him. In truth, when he comes forward, there is nobody but yourself who can meet him." Monticello soon began to function as headquarters for the Republican campaign against the treaty. Madison paid an extended visit to the mountaintop in October 1795 in order to plan the strategy for opposing the treaty in the Virginia legislature, a kind of dress rehearsal for the projected debate in the federal Congress later that year. He left with Jefferson the only copy of his Notes on the Debates at the Constitutional Convention, a clear signal that Jefferson needed to bone up on the constitutional questions at issue, which would form the centerpiece of the Republican position in the congressional debate over ratification. What has come to be called the Great Collaboration was now back in operation and functioning in its familiar fashion. A steady stream of correspondence began to flow from Monticello throughout the fall, rallying Republican support around the position that the Jay Treaty was really nothing more than a treaty of alliance between England and the Anglo-men of this country against the legislature and people of the United States. Indeed, if the gods had seen fit to conjure up a single statement about American foreign policy that was designed to inflame all of Jefferson's deepest fears and most abiding hatreds, they could not have done better than the Jay Treaty. It accepted the fact of English commercial and naval supremacy and thereby endorsed a pro-English version of American neutrality, just the opposite of Jefferson's pro-French version of fair neutrality. It repudiated Jefferson's efforts as Secretary of State to place duties on English imports while accepting England's right to retain tariffs on American imports. Finally, it committed the United States to compensate British creditors on outstanding pre-revolutionary debts, most of which were owed by Virginia planters. Its sole positive feature from the Jeffersonian perspective was the agreement to abide by the promise made in 1783 to evacuate British troops from their posts on the western frontier, but even that concession merely reflected a willingness to implement what the Treaty of Paris had long ago required. What's more, the chief supporters of the treaty were the merchants and bankers of America's port cities. And a clinching condemnation, its major advocate was Alexander Hamilton. In effect, as Jefferson saw it, the Jay Treaty was a repudiation of the Declaration of Independence, the Franco-American Alliance, the revolutionary movement sweeping through Europe, and all the political principles on which he had staked his political career as an American statesman. Subsequent generations of historians, with all the advantages of hindsight, have not seen the same picture that Jefferson saw. The more balanced consensus of posterity is that the Jay Treaty was a realistic bargain that avoided a war with England at a time when the United States was ill-prepared to fight one. It effectively postponed the Anglo-American conflict that Jefferson felt in his bones to be inevitable until 1812, when America was economically stronger and politically more stable, In the even longer view, it linked American security and economic development to the British fleet, which provided a protective shield of incalculable value throughout the 19th century. It bet, in effect, on England rather than France as the hegemonic European power of the future. It therefore repudiated the Jeffersonian presumption that England was an inherently counter-revolutionary force on the downward slope of history. None of these historical insights, of course, was available to Jefferson, who was caught up in an ongoing controversy that put his most cherished political convictions at risk and made all the promises of pastoral seclusion he had made to himself seem like quaint vestiges of a bygone era. Madison had already tried to warn him of what destiny was arranging for him. "You ought to be preparing yourself to hear truths which no inflexibility will be able to withstand." Loosely translated, this meant that Jefferson, not Madison, was the consensus choice of the Republican Party to succeed Washington in the presidency. Now that the Jay Treaty had given the Republicans a popular issue on which to discredit the Federalists, and now that Washington's retirement after two terms was a virtual certainty, Jefferson's re-entry into the political arena had massive implications. Writing in coded language to Monroe in France, Madison explained that the Republicans, knowing that Jefferson alone can be started with hope of success, mean to push him. By the early spring of 1796, whether he knew it or not, he had become the standard-bearer for the Republican Party. This did not mean that Jefferson formally declared his candidacy for the presidency. No self-respecting statesman of the day did that. It meant that he merely neglected to make a public statement declaring his withdrawal. But since Jefferson did not permit the perception of his candidacy to gain access to his conscious mind, even though it was being bandied about throughout the Republican network and in several newspapers, he really had no reason to declare his withdrawal. Madison understood the elaborate system of internal valves that Jefferson could turn off and on so deftly. He therefore understood, it was a difficult dimension of their remarkable collaboration, that Jefferson's willingness to re-enter the political arena depended upon sustaining the fiction that it would never happen. Although Madison spent the entire summer and early fall of 1796 at Montpelier only a few miles from Jefferson, he chose not to visit his mentor at Monticello for fear of being drawn into conversations that upset Jefferson's denial mechanisms. "I have not seen Jefferson," he wrote Monroe in coded language, "and have thought it best to present him no opportunity of protesting to his friend against being embarked on this contest." This psychological minuet enjoyed the advantage of allowing Jefferson to dance back into public life without quite knowing it was happening. On the downside, since he did not acknowledge to himself that his remarks were anything but those of a private citizen, he did not feel accountable to anyone but himself or internalize any need to be guarded in his correspondence. His most damaging statement came in a letter to his Italian friend Philippe Mazzi in April 1796 that effectively ended his cordial relationship with Washington when it was picked up in the American press the following year. "It would give you a fever were I to name to you the apostates who have gone over to these heresies, men who were Samsons in the field and Solomons in the council, but who have had their head shaved by the harlot England. We have only to awake and snap the Lilliputian cords which they have been entangling us during the first sleep which succeeded our labors." If, as everyone at the time assumed, Samson was George Washington, and the reference to shaved heads was a comment on his support for the Jay Treaty, Jefferson's letter was both grossly unfair and extremely impolitic. Characteristically, he claimed that the version printed in American newspapers was a distortion of his meaning, produced by a bad translation from the Italian papers where it originally appeared. But the simple truth was that his sentiments had not been garbled in translation, nor were they a temporary aberration, as some latter-day biographers have claimed. This was how he genuinely saw his political opponents at the time, as apostates and heretics and traitors to the cause of American independence. The moral dichotomies were clear and pure, The colors were black and white. There was no room in his mental universe for the notion that honest and principled men could disagree on a landmark issue like the Jay Treaty and make mutually compelling claims to the truth. He also made some loose comments on the constitutional issues posed in the debate on the Jay Treaty that he would almost certainly have avoided if his guard had been up. Madison had lent him his personal copy of Notes on the Debates at the Constitutional Convention in the fall of 1795, because it was clear by then that the Republican strategy to block passage of the Jay Treaty depended upon throwing the question into the House of Representatives, where the Republicans enjoyed a majority. This required a good deal of constitutional ingenuity, because the power to make treaties rested with the President and the Senate. Indeed, a review of Madison's Notes on the Debates revealed that Madison himself had been one of the staunchest opponents of infringements on executive power over foreign policy at the Constitutional Convention. Jefferson's bold and bald solution to this dilemma was to declare that the true theory of our Constitution allowed the elected representatives in the House an equal share of power over treaties with the President and the Senate, because he regarded the House of Representatives as the most democratic branch of the government, with the closest ties to popular opinion. The representatives are as free as the President and the Senate were to consider whether the national interest requires or forbids their giving the forms and force of law to the articles over which they have a power. Indeed, Jefferson claimed that to deny the House a role was to transform control from the American people to any other Indian, Algerine, or other chief. He even went so far as to tell Monroe that he had no problem in shifting the main responsibility for approving all the treaties to the House, and in annihilating the whole treaty-making power of the executive branch, except as to making peace. These were radical presumptions that, if taken seriously, would have thrown American foreign policy into the cauldron of domestic politics on every controversial occasion. They contrast with Madison's more narrow and careful constitutional argument, which became the official Republican position, that the House could block passage of the Jay Treaty because certain provisions required funding for their implementation, and the House was the proper branch to decide all money bills. Madison's more careful argument made no frontal assault on executive power, but still achieved the desired goal of allowing the Republican majority in the House to hold the Jay Treaty hostage. Jefferson's more extreme position reflected his more cavalier attitude toward constitutional questions in general. Unlike Madison, who had a deep appreciation for the Constitution as an artful arrangement of juxtaposed principles and powers with abiding influence over future generations, Jefferson tended to view it as a merely convenient agreement about political institutions that ought not to bind future generations or prevent the seminal source of all political power, popular opinion, from dictating government policy. His casual remarks in the spring of 1796 during the height of the debate over the Jay Treaty were uncharacteristic only in the sense that Jefferson customarily left constitutional questions in Madison's capable hands. But precisely because he did not feel the obligation to filter his opinions through Madison, his statements more accurately reflected his greater willingness to bend constitutional arguments to serve what he saw as a higher purpose, which in this case was defeat of the counter-revolutionary alliance with England. Upsetting delicate constitutional balances or setting dangerous precedents did not trouble him in such moments. Madison served as the floor manager for the Republicans during the debate in the House of Representatives. It was the first instance when they met in caucus as an opposition party, and the humiliation fell on him when the Republican majority melted away. John Adams observed that Mr. Madison looks worried to death, pale, withered, haggard. When the final vote came in late April 1796, Madison attributed the narrow Federalist victory to an urban conspiracy led by the banks, the British merchants, the insurance companies. In truth, the swing votes had come from Western representatives, whose constituents had decided to support the treaty because the removal of British troops from the frontier promised to open up the Mississippi Valley for settlement. Madison apprised Jefferson that The exertions and influence of aristocracy, Anglicism, and mercantilism had combined to overwhelm the Republican cause and has left it in a very crippled condition. The disaster was so total and so unexpected that, as Madison explained his dismay to Jefferson, "My consolation is in the effect that they have in riveting my future purposes." He was played out and ready for retirement. Jefferson, who had the advantage of viewing the devastation from Monticello, had a fundamentally different and more politically astute appraisal. The primary reason for the Federalist victory, he told Monroe in France, was the gigantic prestige of Washington, the one man who outweighs them all in influence over the people, and whose support for the Jay Treaty proved in the end too much to overcome. Jefferson's conclusion was shrewdly prophetic. "The Anglo-men have in the end got their treaty through, and so far have triumphed over the cause of republicanism. Yet it has been to them a dear-bought victory, and there is no doubt they would be glad to be replaced on the ground they possessed the instant before Jay's nomination extraordinary. They see that nothing can support them but the colossus of the president's merits with the people, and the moment he retires, that his successor, if a monocrat, will be overborne by the Republican sense. In the meantime, patience." Jefferson was usually even more disposed than Madison to regard any Federalist success as the result of corruption and conspiracy. After all, if the vast majority of the citizenry allegedly opposed a particular policy and it nevertheless kept winning victories, the only logical explanation must be conspiratorial. What Jefferson saw clearly in the wake of the Jay Treaty debate, and Madison was simply too closely involved to notice, was that the resolution of the questions raised by the treaty had been reached by a new kind of politics, in which both sides acknowledged that success depended upon an appeal to popular opinion. Washington's nearly unassailable popularity had given the Federalists a decided edge in this particular contest. But once the game had been defined in these terms, that is, once Republicanism became more democratic in character, the Federalists were doomed. Lucky losers. In September 1796, Fisher Ames, the oracular champion of the Federalist cause, observed that Washington's farewell address was a signal like dropping a hat for the party races to start. In fact, the Republicans had been organizing for several months. Jefferson's candidacy had been a foregone conclusion for almost a year. As early as May 1796, Madison had apprised Monroe that the presidential election was likely to pit Jefferson, the object, on one side, and Adams, apparently, on the other. Neither man was expected to campaign. The emergence of an early form of democratic politics had not yet reached that stage of development. It was still considered unbecoming for a serious statesman to prostitute his integrity by a direct appeal to voters. This lingering aristocratic code fitted Jefferson's mood perfectly, for it allowed him to remain sequestered at Monticello throughout the summer, publicly oblivious of the campaign that Madison was waging in his behalf, and even privately capable of sustaining the pretense that he would live out his life in retirement. Madison was the complicitous partner in this psychological game, never corresponding with Jefferson about the looming election until it was over. Even then, when he finally wrote Jefferson in December 1796, his political report studiously avoided mention of Jefferson's candidacy. "It is not improbable that Pinckney will step in between the two who have been treated as the principals in this question," he observed, a reference to efforts by Hamilton to run a third candidate, Thomas Pinckney of South Carolina, who might displace Adams as the Federalist choice for president. "This jockeyship is accounted for by the enmity of Adams to banks and funding systems," Madison went on, "and by an apprehension that he is too headstrong to be a fit puppet for the intriguers behind the screen." Adams, in other words, was not a loyal Hamiltonian. The truth was that Adams disliked Hamilton almost as much as Jefferson did, and after learning about this Pinckney scheme, he loathed him even more. So the next occupant of the presidency was going to be either Jefferson or a man the Republicans could tolerate. Jefferson's first acknowledgment of his own candidacy came in response to Madison's letter. While not attempting to affect complete surprise, Jefferson maintained the posture that Madison had always remained his preferred choice. The first wish of my heart was that you should have been proposed for the administration of government. On your declining it, I wish anybody rather than myself, and there is nothing I so anxiously hope as that my name may come out second or third. These would be indifferent to me, as the last would leave me at home the whole year, and the other, the vice presidency, the other two-thirds of it. Jefferson then informed Madison to put out the word that if the election ended in a tie, he wished it known that Adams should be declared the winner. "He has always been my senior from the commencement of our public life," Jefferson observed with becoming modesty, "a circumstance that ought to give him preference," adding as a final thought that he had no confidence in myself for the undertaking. Over the ensuing weeks, as the result of the electoral vote in the 14 states became clear, Jefferson sustained a public posture of personal reluctance and political deference to Adams. Even before the votes had been counted, he wrote to his old colleague from Philadelphia and Paris days, regretting the various little incidents that have happened or been contrived to separate us, and disavowing any competitive urges. "I have no ambition to govern men," he confided. "It is a painful and thankless task." He was obviously paying close attention to press reports on the voting, since he was one of the first to predict that Adams would win by 3 electoral votes, 71-68, which turned out to be the exact result. But he wished to squelch all rumors that he had any objection to serving under Adams. "I was his junior in life, was his junior in Congress, his junior in the diplomatic line, his junior lately in our civil government." Besides, Adams was, perhaps, the only sure barrier against Hamilton's getting in. The office of the vice presidency was a tranquil and unoffending station that would effectively allow Jefferson to remain in semi-retirement. He expected to spend philosophical evenings in the winter and rural days in the summer. Beneath such expressions of reluctance and deference, which accurately reflected a genuine feeling at one layer of his personality, there existed another, much more realistic assessment of the political situation. While reiterating his political innocence, claiming that, "I never in my life exchanged a word with any person on the subject till I found my name brought forward generally in competition with that of Mr. Adams," he also offered a shrewd analysis of what was in store for the winner. "The second office of this government is honorable and easy," he explained. "The first is but a splendid misery." The chief problem was the long shadow of George Washington. In an uncharacteristically mixed metaphor, he offered Madison this uncanny insight. "The president is fortunate to get off just as the bubble is bursting, leaving others to hold the bag. Yet, as his departure will mark the moment when the difficulties begin to work, you will see that they will be ascribed to the new administration, and that he will have his usual good fortune of reaping credit from the good acts of others and leaving to them that of his errors." In short, whoever followed Washington was virtually assured of failure, and "no man will bring out of that office the reputation which carries him into it." The Republicans had been lucky to lose. Neither Madison, who was too busy trying to diagnose the likely course of an Adams presidency, nor Adams himself, whose combination of vanity and obsession with public duty never permitted such political detachment, was capable of seeing things so clearly. To his credit, Jefferson's first reaction was to share this political appraisal with his long-standing friend from Quincy. He assumed the Ciceroian posture of the retired farmer. He was living, as he put it to Adams, in a secluded canton where "I learn little of what is passing, pamphlets I never see, papers but a few, and the fewer the happier." Though disingenuous, it was a posture Adams understood for what it was and in keeping with the somewhat contrived civility that both men had assumed toward each other in recent years. After congratulating Adams on his victory and assuring him that he never one single moment expected a different issue, Jefferson tried to warn him of the storm into which he was riding. First, there was the subtlety of your arch friend in New York. Hamilton's duplicity was a sure source of complete consensus, who will be disappointed as to you, and contrive behind the scenes to manipulate his protégés in the cabinet. More generally, both the foreign and domestic affairs of the nation were victims of partisan squabbling. Since the day on which you signed the Treaty of Paris, our horizon was never so overcast. He concluded with a reference to earlier and better days, when we were working for our independence, and a vague promise to renew the old partnership. Instead of posting the letter directly to Adams, Jefferson decided to run it past Madison first, just to assure its propriety. Madison counseled against sending the letter, offering 6 reasons why its sentiments might be misconstrued. The last and most politically significant reason was telling. Considering the probability that Mr. A's course of administration may force an opposition to it from the Republican quarter, and the general uncertainty of the posture which our affairs may take, there may be real embarrassments from giving written possession to him. Of the degree of compliment and confidence which your personal delicacy and friendship have suggested. In other words, Jefferson's well-known affection for Adams was admirable, but it must not be allowed to become an impediment to the Republican cause. If Jefferson were correct about the political earthquakes about to shake the Adams presidency, best to keep one's distance. This was excellent political advice that Jefferson immediately recognized as such, but it came at a price. For the bond Jefferson felt toward Adams was palpable. "Mr. A. and myself were cordial friends from the beginning of the Revolution," he explained to Madison, "and although they had parted company on several issues in the early 1790s, these differences had not made me less sensible of the rectitude of his heart, and I wished him to know this. What's more, Adams was no hard-line Federalist of the Hamiltonian stripe. He had, in fact, opposed Hamilton's banking and funding schemes and offered only lukewarm support for the Jay Treaty. Furthermore, Jefferson knew that Adams mistrusted the English as much as he did. The problem was that he mistrusted the French even more. In short, Adams did not fit the Federalist stereotype that both Jefferson and Madison carried around in their heads. Indeed, Adams's first instinct as president-elect was to ask if Madison would be willing to head the American diplomatic delegation to France, and if Jefferson would consider serving in the cabinet rather than waste his talents in the Senate. It was a clear bipartisan gesture designed to offer the Republicans a significant role in the new administration. Jefferson's decision to distance himself from Adams then was both personally poignant and politically fateful. At the political level, one can only speculate about the prospects of a bipartisan government headed by the Adams-Jefferson tandem, which would have enjoyed at least a fighting chance of inhabiting Washington's massive legacy. But such speculation is idle, not just because of Jefferson's decision, but also because the Federalists whom Adams unwisely chose to retain in his cabinet were just as opposed to a vigorous Jeffersonian presence in the new administration as was Madison. They threatened to resign en masse if it occurred. At the personal level, Jefferson was effectively forced to choose between his long-standing loyalty to a friend and his responsibility to the Republican agenda. He was psychologically incapable of seeing himself as a party leader, but that, in fact, was what he once again had become. In his own mind, he was taken off the hook in March 1797, when, after a cordial dinner at Washington's house in Philadelphia, he and Adams walked home together along Market Street, and Adams apprised him that his Federalist associates had vetoed the bipartisan initiative as preposterous. As Jefferson remembered it later, the two old allies took different directions, his being down Market Street, mine off along Fifth, and we took leave, and he never after that said one word to me on the subject or ever consulted me as to any measure of the government. Adams, too, when forced to choose, had opted for party over friendship. Neither man, it should be noted, saw his decision in quite those terms. Adams regarded himself as the American version of the Patriot King, the virtuous chief magistrate who would oppose all factions on behalf of the public interest, even if it meant repudiating his own Federalist colleagues, as it eventually did. Jefferson, on the other hand, saw himself as head of the government in exile, again placed at the anomalous position of serving officially in the administration he opposed. At his swearing-in ceremony, he joked about his rusty recall of parliamentary procedure, a clear signal that his time in Philadelphia would be spent in the harmless business of monitoring debates in the Senate. 3 weeks later, on March 20th, he was already back at Monticello, waiting for the inevitable catastrophes to befall the Federalists and, all in good time, deliver the full promise of the American Revolution into its rightful hands. Chapter 4. Washington, D.C., 1801-04. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. Thomas Jefferson, Inaugural Address, March 4, 1801. I shall take no other revenge than by a steady pursuit of economy and peace, and by the steady establishment of Republican principles, in substance and in form, to sink Federalism into an abyss from which there shall be no resurrection of it. Jefferson to Levi Lincoln, October 25, 1802. Legend has it that he rode to his inauguration as president in splendid isolation and with becoming modesty. According to the apocryphal account, which was based on the fraudulent report of an English tourist, at just before noon on March 4, 1801, Jefferson proceeded down a dusty Pennsylvania avenue in a scene that subsequent image makers ought to have entitled Mr. Jefferson Comes to Washington. His dress was of plain cloth, and he rode on horseback to the Capitol without a single guard or even servant in his train, dismounted without assistance, and hitched the bridle of his horse to the palisade. He then entered the Senate chamber, so the story goes, and gave his inaugural address in an unassuming style and in a voice that one witness, Margaret Bayard Smith, described as almost femininely soft. Indeed, his delivery was so subdued that very few members of the audience could hear what he said. Then, after taking the oath of office, he left quickly and without fanfare and rode back alone to his lodgings at Conrad and McGunn's boarding house. There he placed himself at the far end of the table away from the fireplace, his customary location, and looked to all the world like just another ordinary citizen of the American Republic breaking bread with his equals. The democratic themes of individualism and equality come marching, or perhaps riding, right at us in this legendary rendering. And since Jefferson's ascendance to the presidency is so closely associated with the emergence of a more democratic American society in the early years of the 19th century, it seems perfectly plausible to fit him into the trappings of democratic mythology. Jefferson himself inadvertently contributed to this interpretation when, several years after the event, he referred to his election as the Revolution of 1800, then went on to explain that it was as real a revolution in the principles of our government as that of 1776 was in its form. But what Jefferson actually meant by these words, and what most of his contemporaries thought his election meant at the time, do not rest very comfortably within the mythical imperatives of a democratic culture. Perhaps the best way to dramatize the difference between the democratic legend and the more historically correct reality is to begin with a detached description of what we know about the actual events of March 4, 1801. There is no horse in the picture. It was only a short distance from his rooms at Conrad and McCunn's to Capitol Hill, only a few hundred yards, so he walked. But he was not walking alone. Ahead of him marched a detachment of militia officers from neighboring Alexandria with drawn swords, followed by a delegation of marshals from the District of Columbia. Behind him was a small parade of dignitaries led by a cadre of Republican congressmen and two members of the outgoing cabinet, whose presence was intended to illustrate continuity with the Adams presidency. Adams himself was conspicuously absent, having taken the 4 o'clock stage out of town that morning. There was nearly unanimous recognition among witnesses that the relative simplicity of this little parade was intended to make a political statement. Most commentators emphasized the relative lack of pomp and pageantry and contrasted Jefferson's modest entourage with the coach and sixes used by Washington and Adams at their respective inaugurations. But the operative word was Republican rather than Democratic. No one at the time was disposed to describe Jefferson's election as the coming of the common man. The only observers willing to characterize him as a Democrat were a few diehard Federalists, and they used the term as an epithet, i.e., dangerous Democrat. Jefferson himself had seldom used the word democracy in his public statements or private letters prior to 1800, and he did not start doing so once elected. In a letter to Maria, a few weeks before the inauguration, he adopted his most familiar formulation of the Jeffersonian sense of what was happening. "I feel a sincere wish, indeed, to see our government brought back to its Republican principles, to see that kind of government firmly fixed to which my whole life has been devoted." He saw himself as the instrument for recovery of pure republicanism, by which he meant the political principles forged in the crucible of the American Revolution, principles that had been corrupted by the Federalists, i.e., Anglo-men monarchists, since 1776. In both his own mind and the minds of his supporters, then, Jefferson's elevation to the presidency did not symbolize the ascendance of the ordinary so much as the restoration of revolutionary austerity. The studied simplicity of his clothing and the unassuming demeanor of his little parade as it marched up Capitol Hill was seen as a backward-looking statement about the spirit of 76. In Jefferson's mind, great historical leaps forward were almost always the product of a purging, which freed societies from the accumulated debris of the past and thereby allowed the previously obstructed natural forces to flow forward into the future. Simplicity and austerity, not equality or individualism, were the messages of his inaugural march. It was a minimalist statement about a purging of excess and a recovery of essence. Republican City. If this was what pure republicanism meant to Jefferson and his contemporaries, their intended message enjoyed a perfect natural habitat in the new national capital. For Washington, D.C., in 1801, was the ideal location in which to launch a crusade against excesses. It would have been impossible to imagine courtiers scheming in corridors or conspirators plotting behind locked palace doors, since there were no courts, no palaces, in truth, very few buildings at all. Congressmen who tried to caucus in the corridors of the unfinished Capitol had to compete with the frequent sound of rifle fire from hunters shooting quail and wild turkeys within 100 yards of Capitol Hill. Washington was the perfect Republican city in the awkward sense that it was not really a city at all. The stumps still protruded in several spots up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, perhaps another reason why Jefferson was not conveyed to his inauguration in a coach, and several travelers who stopped to inquire where the new capital of America was located were informed that they were standing squarely in its center. It was doubly appropriate that the first president to take up residence was on record as believing that cities were sores on the body political, since Washington struck most observers as more bucolic than urban, an open wound bleeding into the Potomac River. Jefferson had long regretted the dinner table bargain that led to the southern location of the national capital on the banks of the Potomac. He called it the most misguided decision of his entire public career, but he was referring to Hamilton's crafty diplomacy in seducing him to accept federal assumption of the state debts, not the unlikely placement of the capital in the Chesapeake marshland. Washington himself had made the key decisions about the swampy site and ungainly size of the place. He had selected a natural depression with saucer-like sides that efficiently captured the trapped heat and humidity while serving as an ideal breeding ground for mosquitoes. The surrounding hills were just high enough to impede the movement of air and just low enough to preclude the presence of vistas. Washington had also fused together both urban plans proposed to him, thereby expanding the borders of the city. As a result, instead of beginning with a concentrated population center and spreading out, the city that bore his name began as an expansive but almost empty space that only gradually filled in. European and American tourists were invariably confused upon entering the American capital because the city managers had published elaborate maps and prints showing the layout of the envisioned streets and buildings without explaining that it would take decades for reality to catch up with the vision. Washington's last words on the project, eerily accurate as usual when it came to essential matters, predicted that the vacant spaces would allow the national capital to grow into greatness in about a century. That made Washington a model Jeffersonian city in yet another sense. Namely, it was a bold, some would say preposterous, promise about the nation's latent potential, as if a young man just starting out in life were to draw up a plan for his dream house and then wait confidently for the future to fulfill his expectations. Foreign visitors routinely recorded their disapproval of the presumptuous neoclassical style of the President's House and the Capitol, the only public buildings standing in 1801, which were plopped down in the midst of a marshy field. "The streets are filled with mud in winter and with dust in summer," ran one comic account, "and instead of splendid edifices, you can see nothing but cornfields and plains, dry canals and dirty marshes, where frogs make love in a most sonorous and exquisite strain, and bellow forth their attachments as if they were determined to make no secret of it." Renaming Goose Creek the Tiber served as a source of many jokes about the ridiculousness of an American Rome. A young Irish poet, Thomas More, captured the caustic mood in verse, even taking a swipe at Jefferson himself in the process. "This famed metropolis, where fancy sees squares in morasses, obelisks in trees, which second-sighted seers in now adorn with shrines unbuilt and heroes yet unborn, though now but woods and jay they see, where streets should run and sages ought to be." Whatever deficiencies such doggerel displayed as poetry, it correctly called attention to the obvious disjunction between the physical reality of Washington as a motley collection of villages and the rather presumptuous claim, which over the long stretch of time miraculously turned out to be nearly true, that this pseudo-metropolis was the epicenter of a political earthquake destined to topple all the monarchs and despots on the planet. But at the time, this remarkable paradox looked more like a simple contradiction. The unfinished state of the Capitol made the point graphically. What Jefferson saw as he completed his little parade was a construction site. The center of the Capitol was missing altogether, and the columns designed to support the front facade were lying flat on the lawn. The north wing, where the House of Representatives met, was still a shell with an unfinished roof. Congressmen referred to it as the oven. Jefferson had chosen to be sworn in as president in the Senate chamber primarily because it was the only public building available. Of course, urban and architectural symbolism can carry us only so far in recovering the original sense of Jefferson's inauguration. Once inside the Senate chamber, we enter an interior region in several senses of that term. All the seats on the Senate floor were filled, and the gallery was crowded to capacity. Reporters estimated the audience at about 1,000 people. If we can be sure that they had not come to hear about the arrival of Jeffersonian democracy, but rather about the restoration of pure republicanism, it was by no means clear what that meant. Some sense of the drama and tension lying beneath the surface of the scene greeted Jefferson as he approached the small stage at the bottom of the well of the Senate floor. Waiting to meet him were Vice President Aaron Burr, who had been sworn in earlier that morning, and Chief Justice John Marshall, who was present to administer the oath to Jefferson. Any gathering that included Burr possessed the potential to look like a conspiracy. He was, by the lights of his contemporaries, the most mysterious and mercurial member of the revolutionary generation. John Adams believed that Burr was the only man capable of edging out Hamilton in the race to become an American Napoleon. He was dashing and brilliant in the Hamiltonian style, and his singular advantage over Hamilton, and indeed all competitors, was a total disregard for any moral or political principle that obstructed his path to power. "As to Burr," wrote Hamilton in December 1800, "his private character is not defended by his most partial friends," adding that "Mr. Burr is the most unfit man in the United States for the office of president." Hamilton seemed to sense in Burr a more virulent version of his own throbbing political ambition, just as Burr seemed to sense in Hamilton the only American statesman with the audacity to challenge his own pretensions. The very similarity of their respective temperaments defined their rivalry in life and death terms. If only in retrospect, it seemed eminently predictable that the two antagonists would face off with pistols on the plains of Weehawken 3 years later, and that Burr, unburdened by any quaint code of honor, would coolly send a bullet into Hamilton's spinal column. Why was such an un-Jeffersonian character standing there in the Senate chamber, greeting Jefferson as his second in command? The short answer is that Burr was primarily responsible for Jefferson's election. In the presidential campaign of 1800, Jefferson had once again been matched against Adams. Although Republican candidates for Congress and state office won sweeping victories, Adams ran ahead of the other Federalist candidates at the top of the ticket. In all states except New York, Adams actually matched or exceeded his electoral votes in the 1796 contest, which he had won by a narrow margin. But New York had gone decisively for Jefferson, providing his slim margin of victory. And the man who had delivered the electors of New York to Washington's camp was the irrepressible Aaron Burr, whose price for this important contribution was a place on the ballot alongside Jefferson. An all-important epilogue to this political story occurred during the weeks following Jefferson's victory. It then became distressingly clear that because of a quirk in the electoral system that prevented electors from distinguishing between votes for president and vice president, subsequently corrected by the 12th Amendment, Jefferson and Burr had received the identical number of electoral votes. This threw the election into the House of Representatives, where the Federalists were able to block the majority necessary for Jefferson's election for 6 days and 36 ballots. Even though everyone acknowledged that the American electorate had intended to choose Jefferson as its president, Burr had done nothing to indicate his willingness to defer. Altruistic acts of deference were alien to Burr's style. So the man greeting Jefferson as he entered the Senate chamber was an infamous political schemer who only a few weeks earlier had passively given himself to a Federalist conspiracy designed to cheat Jefferson of the very office he was coming to claim. Then there was John Marshall. By all rights, Marshall should have been a Jeffersonian disciple. A fellow Virginian, even a distant cousin via the ubiquitous Randolph clan, Marshall was a contemporary of Madison and Monroe, who had somehow wiggled through the net that usually gathered Virginia's talented young men into Jefferson's political family. By the time of the Jay Treaty, he had become one of the most prominent of the Federalists. Jefferson wrote him off as a man of lax, lounging manners and a profound hypocrisy. Jefferson's way of designating Marshall a traitor to Virginia's version of republicanism. Marshall's talents attracted Adams's attention by 1797, and he was appointed a member of the all-important American delegation to France, then Secretary of State, and finally, during Adams's last weeks as the lame duck president, Chief Justice of the United States. To say that Jefferson and Marshall hated each other would be going too far in 1801. Hatred came later with greater exposure. In a curious way, Marshall presented difficulties that were a mirror image of those represented by Burr, for Marshall always managed to cloak his personal feelings toward Jefferson behind an elaborately constructed screen of impartial-sounding arguments that invariably ended up leaving him no choice but to align himself on the other side. Just as Hamilton's dislike of Burr was rooted in the recognition of their overlapping ambitions and their common affinity for a flamboyant brand of decisiveness, so Jefferson's mistrust of Marshall was exacerbated by their mutual preference for a more subtle and indirect style that probably had its origins in the Virginia Code of Politeness. If Hamilton came at you with a saber, Marshall preferred the stiletto. On the other hand, Marshall's massive probity was powered by a mind that worked in ways fundamentally different from Jefferson's, which tended to filter and fit experience through primal categories of right and wrong. Marshall worked in more shaded hues and colors, in the middle of the spectrum, and, much like Madison, was more